largely what it comes down to is that people seem to care less about wastewater than water. I think just based on that, we're seeing a lot of companies, and especially IOUs, you know, slowly turning to wastewater.
I am Reese Tisdall, and this is Future of Water, which we talk about all the ways which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. This is episode 98, and I know it's going to be a good one. That's because this one's going to be a little bit different. This time, we're going to address questions asked of our team during the NAWC presentation, which was titled From PFAS to Consolidation, Key Water Market Developments Impacting Utility Strategies. This took place during a webcast a couple weeks ago. Rather than being secretive about it, we thought we'd use this channel to deliver answers to as many of you as possible when it comes to the questions that came to us from behind the scenes. You know, we only had the chance to answer so many questions, and there were a number still out there. And so rather than reaching out to everybody individually, we thought everybody might have similar type questions. So you'll get a better feel for that in a minute. Also, if you miss the webcast, you can let us know at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com, and we can see if there's a way we can get it to you or at least help you out, maybe talk through it a little bit. But to answer your questions, most importantly, I will be joined by Bluefield Research's Charlie Seuss. Not only was Charlie instrumental in delivering the presentation to the NAWC audience, which is National Association of Water Companies, but Charlie also has an in-depth knowledge of the sector. So I guess lastly, why not have a little fun? It's summer after all, so let's do a mailbag. But before we do that, I thought I'd share some news that caught my attention this past week. Earlier this week, Bluefield just released its top companies in water analysis. We do this every quarter, digging into company financials, presentations, M&A, and just looking at the event shaping the strategies of the 50 largest publicly traded companies in water. So it's a pretty diverse group. And so in doing so, as it came out, I thought I'd share some of the data points from Q1 financial reports that caught my eye. So as I said, we look at each company individually, but also in aggregate across all 50, but also within their respective segments. So 36 of the 50 top publicly traded water companies saw earnings growth, 36 out of 50, but overall growth was fairly stable at about 5.9% overall. Engineering services led the growth at about 10.4% over the same quarter prior year. So this change was driven by things like PFAS remediation, but also design and engineering activities, sort of the front end of some of the funding that's going out for IIJA and other infrastructure investments. Treatment technology and solutions grew at about 8.3%. It's worth noting that DuPont's planning to spin off its water business within that space. So look forward to seeing how that unfolds. And I think, you know, obviously PFAS is related to that, as well as lead also. Network and distribution saw a slight uptick of about 1% growth year over year, looking at Q1. Although the combination of the slow rollout of IIJA funds, particularly as you get closer to the projects, our Q1 analysis of IIJA and the funding demonstrates this as well. So looking at the federal outlays and the pace or slow pace at which they're being rolled out for a number of different reasons. And then investor and utilities growth slowed to about 1.5%. This was largely a result of rising costs, but also regulatory challenges at the PUC level for some of the investor and utilities. Since COVID, the pace of rate cases has been slower than maybe it once was. So that's created a bit of friction in some instances or states. So why should we care about this? Well, I mean, not only is it just interesting, but these companies, they're big. They move the needle in many cases, and they provide really interesting insights into the challenges, but also opportunities that are before the water sector. You know, things like corporate spinoffs, launching water peer plays, good examples of this, as I sort of mentioned. And I think I mentioned this on the last Future Water podcast, episode 97. I talked a little bit about DuPont. It's breaking up into three companies, one of which will be about a $1.5 billion water solutions business. It's also worth noting while that happened, just as an aside, that sounds like Veralto and Xylem are also sort of sniffing around DuPont Water Solutions as a potential acquisition target. So not sure where this is going to go. They're obviously looking into it, maybe see it as an opportunity going forward. So it'll be interesting. Otherwise, the spin out will take a couple of years, it looks like. You can also learn more about my thoughts on this. I post things like this on LinkedIn. So if you want to follow me on LinkedIn, you'll hear some of the or read some of these details. I think the other spin out, which is worth noting, is Danaher. They just did this last year in 2023. So Danaher spun out what is now Veralto in their host of water businesses. And this really, I think these spinoffs, the DuPonts or the Danahers of the world, they highlight the trend of companies focusing or trying to focus on their core strengths that are at least enable that by separating their businesses from out under the umbrella of the larger, more diversified holding companies. They'll be more targeted, more specialized. In the case of Veralto and DuPont, you know, it'll put them alongside companies like Xylem, Pure Plays, another Pure Play, Pentair, Curita. They all sit at the top of the roster of water sector peer plays. So it's nice to see a couple more additions. And I think when they're peer plays, they're like I said, they can be more focused, but they can also do M&A more easily because they can do it on their own terms rather than having to go upstairs of a larger, more diversified holding company. So look forward to seeing how this all plays out. So if you're interested in top companies in water, but also I think as I speak, the Bluefield's quarterly M&A, quarterly review of the water sector is being released as well. Those are two areas that talk a bit about all about these topics. But rather hearing me go on and on, let's get to Charlie Seuss and the mailbag questions. All right, so I'm joined here by Charlie Seuss. So Charlie, how goes it?
Doing well. Yeah, looking forward to holiday next week and a little time off.
So for the listeners, just wanted to let everybody know we're a little behind. So we've been sort of dragging our feet because there's a main break. I think it's a main break outside of my house. So I've been dealing with Boston Water and Sewer. The reason I care is because water is flowing into my basement. Not in huge volumes, about 20 gallons a day. I'm having to empty basically a small trash can into the sink twice a day. So I'm doing that every day. I've been doing this for 4 or 5 days now. But Boston Water and Sewer, we've had three crews come by the house. And tomorrow they're going to start doing more acoustic monitoring of the street to see if they can find the solution. They keep trying to push it on me to say it's my problem, but I'm not a believer. I know what the difference between inside the meter and outside the meter. Yeah, so I had to push Charlie back to get this done. So thanks for your patience, Charlie.
Yeah, absolutely. Wasn't going to stop the podcast.
So. Oh, exactly. All right. So here's the deal. So as you know, you and I were both on a webcast with National Association of Water Companies. And as it is for these, we sometimes are restricted by time. I think we answered 2, 3, 4 questions. I can't remember exactly. But on the back end, what everybody, I don't believe, sees is that there are a number of other questions that come our way and we don't have a chance to answer them. So rather than just put answers in writing and send the answers back to the questioners, we've decided to use this podcast to answer these questions. So that's why we're going to call it a mailbag edition. And so we're just going to kind of have to go through the list of questions, but they did seem to break out in a kind of a couple different buckets or areas of focus. So I think the first group we'll start with are sort of system classifications and regulations. And I will say this once again, I said this in the intro, if you're interested in the presentation, just send us a note at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com and maybe we can just send you the presentation and you might get an idea what exactly we are talking about in addition to this podcast. So Charlie, I'm going to throw the first question to you. So during the webcast, you spoke about the relationship between system sizes and violations, but one question that came up was, could you start by laying out what we at Bluefield mean when we say very small systems or very large systems? How does it break out?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, before I jump into all the numbers, to your point, you know, there's a lot of interesting exhibits in those slides that you were talking about. And I think, some of the questions that we got tie in really well to those exhibits and the visuals there. So I definitely, encourage people to reach out, I'm throwing too many numbers out there, but, I guess, to start real basic, there's obviously a huge range in terms of system sizes, but the kind of official EPA classifications that we use are one end, very small systems, 500 people or less, and small 500 to 300 people, medium systems ranging from 3,300 to 10,000, and then large systems, 10,000 to 100,000 people served, and very large systems are everything, greater than that.
Yeah. And I think, just sort of throwing more numbers into that pot of numbers, the very large systems, those are the big ones. Those are the LADWPs, the DC waters of the world. They're serving, obviously more than 100,000, but there are only about 418 of those, at least on the water side of the equation. So it's pretty consolidated among the very large. And then that was really, I think, maybe why it came up. When we start looking at IOUs and utilities, there's so many small and very small systems. And in many cases, we've sort of raised this. That's really where a lot of the constraints are, financially, technologically, resource, workforce-wise, but also where some of the problems are, particularly when we talk about violations. So, but on a related note, one attendee asked, if we can assume that systems serving fewer than 3,300 customers are non-regulated or public. I mean, could you provide like a quick breakdown? I think it would be helpful of the ownership structure or the numbers behind all of that.
Yeah. There are around 50,000 community water systems in the U.S. and those are essentially split between public and privately owned systems. But the private systems tend to kind of lean smaller on average and serve around 14% of the total number of connections or customer connections. So then on the wastewater side, you're looking at about 23,000 wastewater treatment works. 70% of those are going to be publicly owned. But, in contrast to water, these publicly owned wastewater systems serve around 97% of the total number of connections. So a little bit of a difference, whether or not we're looking at water or wastewater here.
And I think also, this is part of the discussion during the webcast with all the attendees, and was, when you say 14% is private, that's not just investor-owned utilities. That's also communities, small communities in Texas or municipal utility districts, not just American Water's IOUs or Essential Utilities or Cal Waters. Well, another question we received sort of in this area, we received another question about normalizing the violation data against a number of systems. I know you've done that, but what does actually the violation data show when we look at it for the systems?
Yeah, that was a good question. So as of April of this year, community water systems in the U.S. had reported around 1,100 health-based violations. If we're just going to talk about that metric for a second, 87% of those violations involved systems serving populations less than 3,300 people, so smaller, very small systems. But when we normalize that data against the number of systems, slightly less than 1% of large and very large systems have recorded a health-based violation, compared to around 2.7% of small and very small systems. So it's not a huge difference when you look at it that way. But again, we're talking about tens of thousands more systems falling into those smaller categories. So the capital needed to address these issues is far more spread out. So I think there's different ways of looking at it there. And then on the wastewater side, kind of a slightly different story. Over the last 3 years, about 2/3 of the facilities that reported effluent violations serve, less than 3,300 people. But again, after normalizing that against the number of systems, small and very small systems are actually 14% less likely to have reported an effluent violation. But I think that could very likely be a result of, less reliable and more incomplete data for smaller systems. So I think looking at the geographic distribution of violations is still really important, just given that some of the gaps in the data that you may come across.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's a good answer, because I think that sort of highlights a lot of the concerns, which I sort of alluded to just a little while ago about the smaller systems and that segment, sort of the fragmentation of it. So next, let's sort of tackle some of the financial and regulatory questions. So sort of back at you, what's a realistic annual cost estimate for PFAS MCL compliance, given that the EPA's $1.5 billion per year estimate seems pretty low now?
Yeah, this is something we really only just very briefly touched the surface on in the presentation. And, you know, I think it's something we have a lot more data and research on, but, you know, happy to share a little bit about that. So last year we had forecast about $13.5 billion through 2030. That's more than likely on the lower end. At the same time, we've seen some global estimates as high as $250 billion by AECOM, around $100 billion, I think it was, by Veolia to essentially eliminate PFAS from the environment as a whole. So quite a big range there, obviously. But, you know, going back to our figures, you know, which is just for drinking water, that is a low and pretty conservative estimate, just because there are still a number of unanswered questions. First and foremost, you know, inventorying the problem and identifying ways to pay for it. But on top of that, you know, the scale is immense. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, regulations and legal systems and governments are still, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions there. So I think one thing I'd consider, though, are the dozen or so states that have already taken steps, even prior to the federal announcement, to establish the new MCLs. So I think our belief is that these states, you know, that have been proactive, you know, are likely to move faster as they've been independently demonstrating, you know, their will to do so.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So we haven't even gotten into the legal challenges and such. I think the expectation is, or the reality is, it's already halfway through 2024. So we're not talking about a long period of time. For first thing we need to do is do some inventorying, figure out the scale of the problem. That in and of itself takes time. So I like that. So how willing are public utility commissions to provide rate relief for consolidators purchasing small troubled systems?
Yeah, this was another interesting question that came in that we didn't have time for, but I think this is an issue that's going to vary, you know, a lot from state to state. For context, you know, coming out of COVID, a lot of the moratoriums on rate increases have been expiring. So a lot of utilities are needing to kind of catch back up in order to pay for these necessary infrastructure upgrades and find ways to address, you know, some of these rising costs over the past few years. So with that in mind, and I think maybe more to the point of the question, there has been a constant push among IOUs and even some of the, you know, kind of regionalized municipal utilities, but in states like Virginia, actually, but to adopt consolidated rates, or in other words, single tariff pricing. So a number of states have already allowed IOUs to do this, but in theory, the essential idea is that it allows utilities to reduce rate shock or ratepayers by spreading the cost of these infrastructure upgrades across multiple systems. So this is a practice that's definitely been met with opposition in some areas that have seen skyrocketing rates without much to show for it in terms of water quality or access or whatever. But on the other hand, it has been an important tool for funding some of the critical customer assistance programs that utilities have implemented for low-income communities. So I think it's a question where the answer can get pretty complex and context specific.
Nice. All right. Well, that's a good one. I agree with you. It's a good question. So, all right, if everybody could just stick with us, we're getting some intriguing market trend questions. So let's change gears a little bit, Charlie. So maybe I see this one and maybe I'll just take this one. So the question is, and also gives you a little bit of a break here. So what are the thoughts on workforce development and the fast approaching retirement wave? Well, given that the team that was out searching for the leak around my house and in my neighborhood this morning, there's going to be a retirement wave coming fast and furious. I can tell you that. That's my own experience. But also just how much information that they need or that they actually have in their head. So sort of in thinking about this, laid out a couple sort of relatively quick answers. So when it comes to our thoughts on it, fundamentally, it's pretty obvious. Critical skill shortage. The water sector faces a significant challenge as a large portion of its workforce retire, you know, they're retiring. So this is particularly concerning for water and wastewater utilities, where it can be really specialized, and in some cases specialized to a neighborhood or to a specific technology. And also technologies are changing. Like they were using, you know, Guterman technology earlier today, trying to find the leak. And you've got to get people trained up, and older workforces may not understand that. So that's one aspect of it. Knowledge transfer, same thing. There's an urgent need to transfer knowledge from one generation of workers to the next, and includes the treatment processes, infrastructure maintenance, and just overall quality or compliance with water quality standards. Technological adaptation, I sort of alluded to this. There's a growing focus on digital solutions. I think the younger the generation, the younger people sort of expect that. They anticipate that when they come into the workforce. This is happening at a fast pace. And so the retirement wave, honestly, a positive way to look at it is this may accelerate the adoption of these technologies, such as digital solutions, advanced monitoring systems. And that could also potentially help bridge the workforce gap. Recruitment challenges, you know, I think the water industry, it may struggle to attract younger workers. You know, when you're comparing yourself to Google or the high-tech, high-flying brands that seemingly a lot of young people, you know, look to for opportunities, the water sector is not that, right? Nonetheless, interesting, but I think recruiting is a challenge and will continue to be. Though it feels like it's stabilized a little bit after COVID, with all this sort of moving around, things seem to be a little bit calmer. Training and education focus, I think that's always a big issue. It does take a long time to train, particularly utility operators. But also, you know, we do need more training and understanding of things like PFAS, advanced treatment. What are the solutions for that? But also the digital technologies that I already mentioned. And then I think overall, I think this is, putting a positive spin on it, this is a potential for innovation. Influx of new younger professionals into the water industry should drive innovation. Like new ideas, new blood, new expectations could change the tenor of activities within the water sector. And I think that's a good thing. All right, I got another one here for you, Charlie. It's changing it back to you. So how has the role of private equity played out in the regulated or non-regulated utility segments?
Yeah, this is a question I think we get a fair amount, you know, across different research areas and services. But at least on the regulated utility side, I think there are a couple of notable examples. First and foremost, Central States Water Resources. That's an IOU, that's an investor-owned utility that's backed by Science Capital. It was really helped drive the company's, honestly, record-breaking M&A spree over the last several years. I can't remember the number right now, but it, you know, I think it was around or over 200 acquisitions over the last 5 years. You know, another one would be National Water Infrastructure. I think that's another name that's worth mentioning. That's a Louisiana-based IOU that's backed by Bernard Capital and has been in recent years kind of working towards a pretty ambitious kind of regionalization project in Louisiana. So that's another one we have our eye on. But I think, you know, on the other hand, in the O&M space for, you know, contract services, we're also seeing private equity firms leveraging M&A, you know, as a way to get their foot in the door. Some of the notable examples being New Mountain Capital's partnership with Infomark. You have Keystone Capital's investment in Clearwater Solutions. And then there's the recent sale of SI Environmental for more equity to LLCP. So there are, you know, a number of examples, you know, even in just the top 15 or 20 O&M providers where private equity firms are really shaping different company strategies.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. So here's another one for you. So how is the and I think this is interpreted as you want. How has the non-regulated market grown in the last decade, and what's its future trajectory?
Yeah, another good one. We, you know, touched a little bit on this in the webcast, but just for context, we've tracked around 1,700 active O&M contracts across the U.S., together representing an estimated $2.9 billion in annual contract revenue as of last year. But the O&M outsourcing market has seen pretty steady, but still slow growth at around 3.85% or so over the past couple of decades. So this is largely a product of kind of this steady flow of mid-sized contracts serving, populations anywhere from, 10 to 50,000 people. But, ultimately, though, I think we do expect this market to continue to grow just due to a lot of the same drivers that we've been talking about, whether it's workforce challenges or compliance issues, outsourcing O&M to a third-party provider, ultimately is often a more appealing option for some utilities that are trying to maintain ownership of their system while still kind of leveraging those same economies of scale.
Yeah, I mean, I think we also included in sort of the spectrum of private participation in water, because some of these contracts are for, 3, 5, 10 years. So they're not concessions, which would be a further extreme. This is really a matter of, a public-private partnership, right? And so, and I think, just for clarification, when we say non-regulated, I mean, I think the investor in utilities call it would it be market-based business units or MBB, market-based business. That's one way to look at it as well. So, but a segment, I agree, that we see real growth opportunities in it. And, we've seen some activities, particularly in the South, Southeast on the water side of the equation. So here's a question, and I think I'm going to take this one. So where do we see opportunities in private water outside the U.S.? So it's a good question. And I don't know why this question came to be. I can't remember what exactly we were talking about when it came in, but I do think I'll just sort of lay it out. We look at the world in three different sort of market types when it comes to private water. I'll sort of get to what I was going to say, and that is there are the purely private markets. So that would be like the UK or Chile, right? These two countries are served by private utilities, kind of sets them apart, really, and for context, sets them apart from the US. For what it's worth, the UK, which is, I think, the world's largest private water market, it's actually, this is what I was getting at, it's been in a bit of turmoil because of Thames Water's recent financial struggles. The London utility, which serves, I think it's like 17 to 20 million people, it's buried in debt and has really become a poster child for, private mismanagement of critical infrastructure, in this case, water and wastewater. So Macquarie, the financial services firm out of Australia, they got out of it in 2017, but they had been paying investors or owners $1 billion over a better part of 10 years in dividends, and the operations of the utility has not been doing so well, so it's not good. So I think really the point being is, while this may not seem like a big deal in the US, it's a different market, I think it does put a bit of a cloud over private participation in water, for good or bad. I don't want to say it's necessarily fair, but people do read the newspaper, whether it be, pick your paper, it can make its way into the US papers. And if you're an investor in utility in the US, it may create some pushback as you look to either acquire or operate or manage a system in the US. The US, so another type of market, is really another type, somewhat unique, because it really includes a pretty broad mix of public munis, private investor owned utilities. So I've also got the contract operators. It's somewhat surprising to outsiders that P3s, like the bigger ones, outsiders kind of look to the US, say, why aren't there P3s? It's a financial tool, really, to supposedly benefit the utilities, but you don't really see them that often. They pop up periodically. We've seen one more recently, actually. I think, Charlie, you've done some research on it, on the facility in Florida that is a P3. I think Kiewit is involved in that. So that's interesting. One would think there would be more, but it seems to be a tough row to hoe, as I would say. And then lastly, Bluefield has historically tracked utility concession markets around the world. These include countries like France, Spain, Italy, Brazil, Colombia, to a lesser extent. We also account for concessions and P3s across hundreds of desal plants in the Middle East, North Africa, Australia, China. So that is a market opportunity. They're not fast changing, and there are companies that are pretty well established in that space. So in many respects, it's pretty consolidated among a core group of players within the respective markets. Also might add, you sort of within that group, I would also add like Consolidated Water is also one of our top companies in water that we track quarterly. They've carved out somewhat of a unique position as an independent water provider in markets throughout the Caribbean. They've sort of also looked at Mexico and other places, but they're an interesting player as well because they've got some desalination and water utility assets that they, I guess, own and operate or have a concession for in the Caribbean. So I think it's pretty interesting to see where that is. Like Charlie, you know, speaking for him, we spend a lot of time looking at the U.S. and the investor in utilities, but that being said, we also do look at what's happening in Europe and the rest of the world. All right. So I think this is the last group of questions coming your way, Charlie. So let's look at some broader trends. So one thing that came up, and I think I know why it came up, but the question is, why is wastewater seen as a less risky and more attractive market entry channel?
Yeah, this another good question that I think maybe might depend a little bit more on, you know, who you ask in the sector. But, you know, honestly, it I think largely what it comes down to is that people seem to care less about wastewater than water. I think it, just based on that, we're seeing a lot of companies and especially IOUs, you know, slowly turning to wastewater. Essential utilities is probably the largest one that comes to mind. You know, recent years, we've seen them going after, you know, probably larger municipally owned wastewater systems. So kind of a shift away from water. And then again, you know, Central States M&A activity over the last several years has largely been focused on smaller wastewater systems in the South. So it's certainly something we've seen there. But, you know, additionally, I think, you know, wastewater does present certain opportunities for utilities to take advantage of, you know, certain efficiency gains, you know, whether we're talking about power management or energy capture or even reuse and recycling. So I think that's actually a pretty exciting aspect to the wastewater side. But again, you know, drinking water is a serious thing that, you know, where it's critical to human health. And I think for that reason, you know, the public can be, you know, justified in being a little more wary of change, and regulators are equally cautious.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've heard some people say it, you know, like, don't touch the drinking water, right? It's so, you know, because then you do have to be pretty risk averse. There's a lot at stake when you're managing water, with, you know, for a community, let's say. So, all right, that's helpful. So I think we're looking at the last one here, Charlie. So it's a banger. Beyond the bipartisan infrastructure law, what's the outlook for future federal incentives in the water sector?
Yeah, I think there are, you know, two, you know, main ones that come to mind here for me. You know, obviously everyone's excited about, you know, IIJA, the bipartisan infrastructure law, which has provided some, you know, important tailwinds to the sector. But, you know, first, WIFIA, or the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, that's a program that provides long-term, low-cost supplemental loans for, you know, regionally and nationally significant water projects. So, you know, with the potential for expanding that, WIFIA could really become a more critical source of funding for large-scale water infrastructure projects. And then the other one that I would mention would be SRF, you know, State Revolving Funds. So both the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, as well as the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, are, you know, they're both key sources of funding for water infrastructure improvements. IIJA has obviously, you know, infused a lot of dollars into those programs, but I think we also, you know, think, you know, are seeing that future federal budgets, you know, are expected to increase, you know, allocations to these funds, and that would, you know, in turn enable states to finance more water quality projects. But there might, you know, there's probably a couple I'm missing here. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add.
Yeah, I mean, I think we looked at it, particularly when I think the Infrastructure Week was being discussed or rolled out. Was that 2021? You know, I think one interesting thing, I guess maybe positive thing about water is that it touches everything, right? So when you get things like Inflation Reduction Act and there's investment in hydrogen, or the CHIPS Act and it's focused on semiconductors, there is a water component to each of those among all the others. So, you know, or transportation. So, you know, through the bipartisan infrastructure law, or IIJA, let's say the water sector gets $55 billion in new funding. Transportation gets, I think it was $105 or $110 billion. So twice as much, essentially. But when you build a road, you also need culverts, you need catch basins, you need a lot of other sort of hardware and equipment to help manage the water associated with transportation. So it's not an all or nothing federal incentive program to look at. You know, there are some dedicated, I think you pointed out the biggest ones that most people talk about, water infrastructure, WIFIA, should I say, and then state revolving funds. But when there are other dollars going into different sectors, you know, water opportunities do exist within those. I think, you know, the other thing I would also add, and I think we even raised this, I believe, during the webcast, and that is, these big waves of federal funding seem to come either after the Great Recession or, you know, more recently after COVID and infrastructure. I think the bigger concern is we need probably more dollars, a more sustainable approach to water infrastructure investment. The floor could come up, but also in a more regular ongoing basis. It shouldn't be a reactive, oh my God, we have to generate jobs, or we have an infrastructure problem, so let's deal with it. Infrastructure is not going away. It's not getting any younger. It requires ongoing maintenance, operations, and investment. So, I think you pretty much nailed it. So I like that. I don't know with anything else to add, Charlie, why don't we, while I have you, since I don't have any more questions to ask that came from the webcast, what are you working on these days and what can we expect to hear from you research-wise?
Yeah, definitely. We covered a lot today, but there's, you know, we're certainly staying busy this summer. We've got a U.S. pipe vendor market share report in the works. We're kind of in the middle of this large annual exercise, number of us working on, collecting over, 800 utilities capital improvement plans. And I think there's a lot of exciting, additions to that this year that folks can look for later this summer. And looking forward to, what's coming out and what's coming down the pipeline here.
Yeah, I've been given a lot of shout outs on the podcast past couple of episodes. One goes to the intern team that is helping us work through all those capital improvement plans. I mean, it's a heavy lift for those who haven't collected capital improvement plans, or at least, pulled all the data out project by project. It's a big lift. So, and they're actually moving towards the finish line. So they've probably gone fast. We've done this for years, three years in a row at this scale, and they move faster and faster. We're also getting better as far as using sort of select tools as well. So good on everybody for that. But yeah, I'm interested to hear and learn more about sort of the pipe markets. And then we also have our big forecast we're working on. So, all right, Charlie, well, with that, I think I can set you free. So you are free to move on to bigger and better pastures than this. So thanks for the time and the time of this recording. I hope you enjoy the weekend.
Thanks, Larry. You too.
All right. Take care. All right. That was super helpful to have Charlie at least join me on that. I'm not sure I could answer all those questions. So he took the hard ones. I took the easy ones. Before we sign off, if you're in Boston or Barcelona, let us know. We'd enjoy the opportunity for a meeting. Also, please give the Future Water Podcast a review. Super helpful to us to understand that you're listening. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions about the podcast or anything for that matter, such as the webcast presentation, send us a note at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. We're always wanting to hear what you've got to say, but also what you're looking for. We're doing this for you, as I say, always. And lastly, tell a friend about it. This podcast and these water and industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and take care.